Thank you for inviting me to speak here, and I'm afraid the subject of my talk is not quite string theory. As you can see, it's actually gauge theory. But I still think it's not inappropriate to speak about this here, because the subject of disorder operators is closely related to the subject of dualities in gauge theories, and of course dualities in gauge theories and string theories are very closely related. So, and some of the stuff that I'm going to discuss is worked out in more detail in this paper here. From last winter, and there will be some more references along the way. So when I was preparing for this talk, I was trying to find a suitable quote from Einstein, but failed. So the least, well, the least inappropriate seemed to be the following one. Being creative is knowing how to hide your sources. So that's why I'm going to be very careful about quotations here. So, first of all, what's disorder operator? Well, the terminology is pretty old. Comes from the two-dimensional Ising model, and they were first constructed in the late 60s. So, as everybody knows, the two-dimensional Ising model describes spins on a lattice, and the Hamiltonian is just given by this sum over links. If beta is positive, then the spin variables, which you can take values plus or minus one, tend to be, well, the neighboring one tend to be aligned, so it's a ferromagnetic Ising model. And in this theory, there's an obvious observable, local observable, the value of this variable sigma at a particular site. Well, it turns out that there is a much less obvious observable called the disorder operator, called mu, and it's defined in some bizarre way. So one picks a site on the dual lattice, P, and then one draws a path on the dual lattice all the way to infinity, or maybe to another insertion of the disorder operator. And then one flips the sign of beta for all the links which intersected by this path. It's claimed that this operation is equivalent to insertion of a local operator in the Ising model, and one can, well, superficially it seems to depend on the choice of path, but it's easy to show that it doesn't, actually. So this is a very non-obvious operator, and the reason it's interesting is the following. In the low temperature phase, the expectation value of sigma is non-zero. The spins are aligned, the spontaneous breaking of the Z2 symmetry. The disorder operator, it turns out, creates a domain wall. So, since, semi-infinite domain wall, and so its energy is basically infinite, so excitation value of this operator is zero. In the high temperature phase, it turns out it's the other way around. Well, first of all, it's obvious that in the high temperature phase, the spins are disordered, so the excitation value of sigma is zero, and in the, well, it turns out the excitation value of the disorder parameter is non-zero. And more amazingly, it turns out that there's a duality which exchanges the high energy and low temperature phase, and which actually exchanges these two totally different operators. So this illustration, so the disorder operator is just basically some operator which is defined in some non-obvious way in terms of the variables which are used to write down the Hamiltonian. Well, so there's a more symmetric description of the same thing where one says that near the critical point, the Ising model is equivalent to a theory of a Majorana fermion, and then neither the order operator sigma nor disorder operator mu are obvious. But nevertheless, they are in the theory. There are obvious operators which are polynomials in this variable psi and its derivatives, but then there are less obvious operators called the twist operators. They're defined not as polynomials in the fundamental field psi, but as by saying that the path integral of psi should be done over fields which are not univalued. So when you insert say, an order operator sigma at a point, that means in terms of psi that psi is actually antiperiodic as one goes around this insertion point. So it's some bizarre way to define an insertion of an operator. And it turns out actually that there are two such guys. So namely there's sigma, but there's another. Well, if you be more careful about what is the asymptotic of psi as one approaches this point, it turns out that there are actually two different operators with this property, that psi is antiperiodic in their presence. And one is the order operator and the other one is the disorder operator. So in this approach, sort of both sigma and mu can be sort of a disorder operator in some sense because they're not local with respect to the field of psi. So that's the meaning which I'm going to use to say what a disorder operator is. So I'm interested in gauge theories. And in gauge theory, well, the first example of a gauge theory where the disorder operator was considered was a complex U1 gauge theory in three dimensions. So in this theory, one can consider an operator which is defined by the following funny condition. You want the integral of the gauge field along a two-sphere, or the field strength along a two-sphere surrounding this point to be 2 pi n. Okay. So clearly this means, well, it means that there is magnetic flux inserted at this point, and in particular it means that the gauge field is singular at this point. Okay. These sort of so-called monopole operators. So I want to discuss why Polyakov needed these operators, but this was the first example of a disorder operator in a gauge theory, I think. So this magnetic charge, of course, does not determine the operator uniquely. This observation is going to be important for us later on. So it only determines the topology of the gauge field. But suppose there are other fields in the theory, then one has to also specify how they behave near the insertion point. They may be singular, or maybe they're not singular. For example, if there's a scalar field, it may also be singular at this point, P. Okay. Just saying that magnetic flux is there doesn't mean that you define the operator. Well, for example, if you have supersymmetry, you can fix this ambiguity by requiring the operator to be BPS. So then, if the gauge field has singularity, and if phi is in the same supermultiplet as the gauge field, then phi also should be singular, so you get this BPS monopole insertion. Well, if there are matter fields, one has to work, well, there's even more ambiguity, one has to consider what kind of singularities are possible for the matter fields. So as a result, for example, monopole operators may carry non-obvious flavor quantum numbers. Well, there's an analog of this in 1 plus 1 dimensions, because twist operators in a system of many fermions also carry some weird flavor quantum numbers. So these are examples that are topological and sort of familiar. What I actually would like to discuss is that there may also be non-topological disorder operators. What do I mean? Well, so disorder operator for me is an operator which is defined by specifying what kind of singularity the basic fields have at the insertion point. Now, this singularity may be detectable from afar if the topology of the field is non-trivial around the point, like in this monopole example. But consider, say, the gauge theory with gauge group at U2 in three dimensions, say, and with matter in the fundamental representation. So in this case, if you draw a two-sphere surrounding the insertion point of a putative disorder operator, there's no possibility for non-trivial topology. Any FU2 bundle on the two-sphere is trivial. That's because the only possibility for non-trivial topology comes from the gluing from the gauge transformation defined on the equator, and the gauge transformation then is simply a map from a circle to the gauge group. And since FU2 is simply connected, there is no possibility for non-trivial gluing, and all the bundles are topologically trivial. Well, if head up to the group SO3, then the situation would be different. Then this group is not simply connected, so there are actually two different possibilities for gluing northern hemisphere to southern hemisphere, and so that two topologically non-equivalent bundles, and that's why one gets a sort of monopole charge which takes valence in Z-mod 2. It's called the proof magnetic flux. But in the situation I'm considering, when the gauge group is SU2, not SO3, there's no non-trivial topology. So the question is, are there non-topological disorder operators in this situation? Well, I could stay in three dimensions. And in fact, it was argued a couple of years ago by Borokov, who was my student at the time, that such operators actually are required by three-dimensional mirror symmetry. But instead I'll discuss analogs of this in four-dimensional gauge theory. Well, one reason is because they're more relevant to the real world, and another reason is that there are many weakly coupled gauge theories in four dimensions, so I'm going to study the features of weak coupling. While in three dimensions, typically you have to work with strong coupling. Okay. So what is the motive? Well, first of all, here's the motivating question. What is the magnetic analog of the Wilson loop operator, which looks like this? So the Wilson loop operator depends on two things. It depends on closed path C and on the representation R of the gauge group. So is this a magnetic analog of this? And the standard answer is due to a truth, who also was motivated by this example of the Ising model. So he said, well, if we have a gauge group which is not simply connected, like SUN mod ZN, we can consider some operator which is localized on some closed loop C. And if you look at closely at some neighborhood of some point on this loop, well, the neighborhood is homotopic to just, it's equivalent to basically topological to S2. So, and again, we have the possibility for non-trivial topology if the gauge group is not simply connected. Well, he didn't phrase it this way, but it's equivalent to what he said. So if we require this bundle to be non-trivial on S2, then, different gloomings are labeled by elements in this group, and the fundamental group of the gauge group, and in the case of SUN mod ZN, it's just Z mod N. So we get a Z mod N valued sort of magnetic flux for this loop operator. So that's not completely satisfactory, because we know theories which are believed to have exact S duality. So N equals 4 supreme nodes with gauge group SUN. So N equals 4 gauge theories with gauge group SUN, for example, R self-dual, on flat space, then you can ignore the difference between SUN and SUN mod ZN. And we have Wilson lines, which are labeled by representations. So this should be magnetic Wilson loops labeled by the same data, by representation of the dual group, which in this case is actually the same as the original one. Okay. Well, another even more striking example, Seibert and Witten argued in 1994 that certain N equals 2 supreme loop theory, namely with gauge group SU2 and 4 hypermultiplets in the fundamental, also exhibits S-duality. In this case, the group is really SU2, not SO3, so there's no non-trivial topology at all. Okay. Now, nevertheless, the theory, of course, has a Wilson loop in the fundamental representation. So what's the S-dual of that operator? Well, according to Hooft, you would say that there are no disorder operators at all. So I guess we have to consider non-topological disorder operators to understand this duality. So in what follows, I'll consider a four-dimensional conformal field theory for simplicity, but it's not really a limitation because when you define operators, you should really think about the ultraviolet of the theory, so you insert them in the ultraviolet limit of the theory. And in the ultraviolet, any reasonable theory becomes a conformal field theory. So from now on, I'll assume that I'm in a conformal field theory. So then I also look at a small piece of my putative magnetic Wilson loop, maybe some dionic Wilson loop, which involves both electric and magnetic charge. So here's this piece. Of course, there are all kinds of So, of course, there are all kinds of operators, but the one which could, say the Wilson loop, which is also depends on the line, it has an interesting property. It breaks, it doesn't break any more symmetry than the geometric line. So you have superconformal, or have conformal symmetry, and this line breaks some of the symmetry. But the Wilson operator doesn't break any more symmetry than this line itself. Okay. So the dual should also have this property. So that puts some restrictions on what sort of singularity of the fields are allowed at this line. So to make this more explicit, it's convenient to write, well, do some Wiley scaling. So one writes the metric in cylindrical coordinates, but T is the coordinate along the this piece of loop C, and R is the radial coordinate, and we scale the metric by 1 over R squared. So then the metric becomes a product metric on Euclidean ADS2 and 2 sphere. So so it's clear then that the symmetry we're trying to preserve is a product of SL2R and SO3. Okay. So classifying line operators with this preserving all the symmetry, the same as classifying the boundary conditions for gauge fields on ADS2 cross ST. Okay. So we should just ask what sort of boundary conditions are allowed if you want to preserve the whole symmetry of ADS2 cross ST. Well, there are two sort of obvious cases. One can consider free boundary conditions. That's when the gauge field is in the ADS2 direction, sort of has this form where the restriction is not constrained. Okay, you just allow it to be something on the boundary. And that's sort of boundary condition which is related to the Wilson loop. Namely, if you allow the gauge field to have this form near the boundary, and also insert in the path integral the Wilson loop, sort of located at the boundary, then then for example, if you vary, well, the saddle point, for example, will say that actually this A of T classically is non-zero. It corresponds to the Coulomb field. Okay. So these are free boundary conditions, but also fixed ones. One can consider the gauge field at which at the boundary asymptotes simply to the volume form of the S2. So it doesn't have any components along ADS2, but one has components along S2. And if you want SO3 symmetry, then this, well, F is a, well, it's a non-abelian gauge field. So B is not a number or a function, it's a section of the adjoint bundle, and if you want SO3 symmetry, it's supposed to be a covariantly constant section of the two spheres. Or if you write it in Euclidean, well, in flat coordinates, it simply means that near R equals zero, the gauge field is, has its asymptotic. So, this problem has been analyzed a long time ago, 1977, by Goddard, Newton, and Olive, but in somewhat different context. They looked, they studied the same ansatz for gauge field, but spherical symmetric ansatz, but assumed that it holds for R goes to infinity, not R equals to zero. So that is, they were studying spherical symmetric configurations of gauge fields, looking for the non-abelian monopoles. And from my point of view, these are, well, we can use their results, but the interpretation is different. They're going to classify not some, well, they're going to classify operators in the gauge field. Now what they found is that the, this, well, section of the adjoint bundle should be sort of quantized, satisfy the quantization condition. And the reason for this is fairly simple. If you look at this two sphere surrounding our insertion of the loop operator, and contemplate this path, sequence of paths like this. So one can compute parallel transfers along each of these paths. And the parallel transfer takes values in the gauge group, so as one varies the path, one gets a loop in the gauge group. And the requirement really be a loop, not a path, forces B to satisfy this condition. Okay. So the loop better be closed. That's because, you know, in the beginning the holonomy is almost one, and the end is also basically one. So, well, this path may or may not be topologically trivial. So if the group is not simply connected, it's possible this path is topologically non-trivial, and then you have non-trivial at Hoof magnetic flux. And another observation of Goddard, Newton, and Olive is that this element is defined modulo, or since it's fairly constant, I can just look at some particular point on S2. Then it's just a Lie algebra element. And this Lie algebra element is defined modulo constant gauge transformation. Well, if you rotate this Lie algebra element in the Cartan subalgebra, you can always do that, then the quantization condition simply says that the any root of the gauge group takes integral values on this Lie algebra element. So in other words, the Lie algebra element B belongs to the dual of the root lattice, which I'll call the magnetic weight lattice, also known as co-weight lattice. And then there's also residual gauge transformation, the Weyl reflection. So the actual magnetic charge takes values in the in the magnetic weight lattice modulo the Weyl group. And that's known as the GNO charge. So that's magnetic loop, well, magnetic Wilson loops are classified by the GNO charge. So just a couple more remarks. Well, first of all, this is a refinement of a Hooke classification because according to it, well, this magnetic weight lattice has a sublattice, the lattice of coroutes. The quotient of the two lattices is actually the group where the Hooke magnetic flux takes value. So basically, when GNO charge is in the coroute lattice, then it's especially when Hooke flux is trivial. So dealing with the refinement of a Hooke classification. And the second observation due to GNO is that the lattice of magnetic weight is the same as the weight lattice of the Langlands dual Lie algebra. And therefore, the GNO charges are in one-to-one correspondence with irreducible representation of the dual Lie algebra. And they interpret as an evidence for electromagnetic duality, and this reinterpretation of the results allows to understand better why it had to be true. Because the same data that classify their spherical symmetrical under classify magnetic Wilson operators. Now, we now know that there is a whole S-duality group. One should combine S-duality with the shift of the theta angle. One should understand them also bionic operators. This is simple, but not completely trivial. So the point is this. If you have a non-trivial magnetic charge, or GNO charge, then you have magnetic field in the neighborhood of the operator, and that breaks the gauge group G. So the electric charge cannot take values in the, cannot attach a Wilson loop in, it shouldn't attach a Wilson loop in the original representation of the original gauge group, but only in the representation of the residual gauge group, the one which is left unbroken by B. Well, if you rotate everything to the Weyl, to the Cartan subalgebra, then same thing happens. That is, the Weyl, this element B breaks the Weyl group down to some residual Weyl group. So it should a representation, electric part of the operator is parameterized not by a weight of the original gauge group, but a weight. So in the original gauge group, representation is parameterized by weight modulo the action of the full Weyl group. But here we have to specify a weight and then only quotient by the residual Weyl group. Well, just to rephrase them, bionic operators are labeled by a pair. Here, the first element is sort of electric charge, is fixated in the weight lattice, and the second one is in the magnetic weight lattice. And then there's also an action of the Weyl group on the both of them, not on separate. So you see, it's almost like if you had two gauge groups, one magnetic, one electric, but not quite, because there's only one Weyl group, not two. So this consideration is actually true in any gauge theories, but first of all, one can actually do computation with operators. At recoupling, one can compute correlators. So in my paper, I show how to do this in some examples. But I'd like to discuss a sort of more kinematic issue. And then one can consider how S-duality acts, that is, the whole S-duality group acts on this operators. And one can, for example, show that under the shift of the theta angle, the electric sort of part shifts by the magnetic part. That's another manifestation of the Witten effect. And so the F transformation is actually more interesting. The obvious way to define an F transformation is this one. It should basically exchange electric and magnetic guides. And that indeed, this transformation together with the T transformation, they generate SL to Z. That does work for simply laced groups, but for non-simply laced exceptional groups, actually doesn't work. And the reason is that this transformation actually is not well defined. If you take a weight, then it usually doesn't lie, doesn't belong to the magnetic weight ladder, so it actually doesn't make any sense. So the F transformation, as stated here, is not well defined. What's well defined is this combination for the gauge group F4 and this one for the gauge group G2. So together with the T transformation, then generate not SL to Z, but some subgroup known as gamma naught of M. Okay. Now, problems with this definition of S arise because the S duality group for F4 and G2 actually is not SL to Z. It's some subgroup of SL to R, whose intersection with SL to Z is gamma naught of 2 or gamma naught of 3. This was first noted by Dory, Fraser, Holland, and Knate in 1995, sort of, but little noticed, and this is another manifestation of this. Let me make a couple more remarks about these operators. So, first of all, I should stress that these new operators on gauge theory probably do not provide new order parameters for confinement or fixed phase or whatever. So for that, order parameters for the phases, you know, are well enough classified by the usual topological disorder operators. The perimeter law, area law doesn't care about this finite classification, presumably. For example, a Wilson loop in the adjoint can be completely screened by a gluon. So we expect also that if the magnetic weight is the highest weight of the adjoint of the dual group, it is also some screening there. But actually, it's not completely trivial to see that it happens. The reason is that we would like to screen a magnetic Wilson loop in the adjoint by BPF monopole, by Fuchs Polyakov monopole. So insertion of this magnetic Wilson loop is like inserting a Dirac monopole embedded in the non-abelian gauge group, so a singularity in the gauge field. Now, a Fuchs Polyakov monopole is a big, fat object. So it seems like even if you put it on top of the Dirac monopole, it's not going to kill the singularity. So unlike the gluon, which is a point-like object thing, BPF monopole is a soliton. So how can it screw in a point-like thing? So we could say, well, you know, this is a weak coupling consideration, and a strong coupling becomes very small. But that's not really satisfactory because the screening, if it's there, should be visible already at the weak coupling. And actually, there is a way out of this. And turns out that as the BPF monopole approaches the Dirac singularity, actually shrinks to zero size. So there's no explicit solution for BPF monopole in the presence of a Dirac monopole, as far as I know. But one can argue, well, the moduli space is known, and one can use the known moduli space to argue for that. Or one can use a stringy argument, so you can realize the XAC2 gauge theory, realized on a pair of D3 brains. A Dirac monopole can be realized by, you know, inserting a pair of D strings like this. And a Fuchs Polyakov monopole is this interval of a D string, which can move back and forth. And as the D string, well, actually the picture looks like this because all the strings deform the D3 brain. But as the D-string approaches this infinite D-string, you get this configuration. And then this D-string can actually move off D3 brain, leaving nothing behind. So that sort of illustrates, I guess it's convincing enough to show that when the Fuchs Polyakov monopole collides with the Dirac singularity, it becomes point-like and cancels it. So why should we be interested in disorder operators? Well, they're probably not order parameters for phases of gauge theories, but the interesting probes of duality. So what I mean is the following. For example, consider the cyber duality of supersymmetric QCD with another similar gauge theory. Well, it's believed that it's some sort of electric-magnetic duality. But what does it actually mean? For example, what is the dual of the Wilson loop in the fundamental representation of S2N? If you really believe that it's electric-magnetic, then it should be some sort of magnetic Wilson loop. If you use a full definition, you say, well, it doesn't make any sense because the dual has a simply connected gauge group, so it doesn't have any disorder operators. But now we know that non-trivial topology is not required, really, so now we can ask, again, the same question in this more refined context and ask whether the dual of the Wilson loop is really the magnetic Wilson loop. So I'll stop here.
Question? Okay, let's thank Anton again, and let's move on to...